the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Welcome to What Radicalized You, a podcast of stories and experiences that have shaped people's ideas about our world and the way society should function.
My name's Matthew, and I'm a writer. I grew up in kind of a very stereotypically, you know, average American household, raised evangelical Christian. You know, I'm white, I'm a male, I'm straight, heterosexual. So I had a lot of privilege growing up, and, you know, I kind of just blended in. I was very conventional minded, just into sports and video games and things like that. But after I graduated from high school, I got a job at this local independent bookstore in my hometown. And this is kind of the whole, like, oh, I'm going to work for a year to save up for college. You know, I was in the shipping department, and I would literally see every single book that came into the store with the shipments, and I had to check in all the books, record information in a computer database, and all that kind of stuff. So eventually I started seeing, like, Noam Chomsky books, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's kind of like anti-establishment. It's very different from what I was raised to believe, traditional kind of American education system. So I started reading these little pamphlets that were, they're basically transcribed interviews from Noam Chomsky throughout the years on different topics. I started broadening my horizons and started, you know, initiating my political education. And then the main book that really inspired me was Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. This is a very common kind of book that is very eye-opening to people when they read it because of the propaganda we're fed as children and as young adults and basically throughout our lives regarding this myth of American exceptionalism and that, you know, the U.S. is the good guy in the world and we're the greatest country ever and all that bullshit. So that book really opened my eyes and kind of started me on a path to becoming more of a leftist, kind of evolving into basing my politics around, you know, the working class. And regardless of all of the ways in which I was privileged, eventually I was struggling financially and still am. So that's another thing that radicalized me. But moving on from those early days, you know, I went to college and I was continuously kind of seeking out additional sources of information. A lot of them were leftist, including anti-imperialist and sort of anti-war perspectives. And this was during the Bush administration. So when I was working at this bookstore was kind of the lead up to the invasion. This was around 2002, 2003, the invasion happened and the US occupation, very brutal. Even at the time, being in my early 20s, I was passionate about calling attention to this. I was at a lot of Iraq war protests in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and kind of trying to raise awareness of this. It was just horrific. The US was killing hundreds of thousands of innocent people and destroying an entire nation. So this is something that really radicalized me initially. And, you know, I would include a lot of critiques of the Bush administration in my art projects. I was attending art college at that point. Another thing that led me on the track to being a leftist and radicalized was finding out about the Israeli occupation of Palestine at a pretty early age, in my early 20s. And I actually heard I attended a talk by Norman Finkelstein, who is an academic who has been very critical of Israel's occupation and apartheid policies in the West Bank, as well as Israel's brutal war crimes, you know, spanning decades at this point, and the initial displacement of hundreds of thousands of indigenous Palestinians, which was how Israel was formed. So I developed this knowledge and this critique of Israel as, you know, a colonialist and apartheid state pretty early on. But regardless of that, I still remained kind of, I vaguely defined myself as a socialist, and I voted for Democrats in some of the first elections I participated in. So there was always this, I feel like it was kind of this privilege that I had that prevented me from espousing a more revolutionary politics. So that came much later. basically the election of Trump really radicalized me further. And at first I was really disturbed by it, and I was falling into the kind of liberal so-called Trump derangement syndrome, in which I was like, you know, how the fuck can this happen? You know, this, you know, all the stuff of this is an aberration, you know, this is not normal. But I quickly kind of got back on track and was reading more leftist analysis. And I realized that, you know, Trump is really a natural extension of the current political system in the U.S., the hyper-capitalist system based on colonialism and genocide and racism, white supremacy, all these true American values that we try to bury and try to omit from our discourse. You know, this is what Trump truly represented. And not only that, but like the neoliberal system also helped create Trump, helped bring him to power in various ways. And that includes the Democratic Party. So I kind of started realizing this stuff and getting more in tune with this radical and revolutionary analysis of the two-party system being essentially a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, two parties that both represent the capitalist class. And from there, I kind of sought out more revolutionary analyses of the situation in the U.S. And then building upon the, you know, Howard Zinn book, A People's History of the U.S., which exposed a lot of the more monstrous and controversial aspects of U.S. history, including U.S. foreign policy, I started realizing that there was a lot more about history that was distorted, including the history of socialist and communist movements. So there's a lot of anti-communist propaganda in the U.S. I started realizing that, reading about it, researching it. And so one of the things that helped me in this process was I started writing political commentary, trying to just sort of like, it's kind of a therapy, kind of like an outlet for me. So I was reading a lot of books, more often than not, socialist or communist orientation, and trying to figure out my own political analysis, my own refined political views. But I started just responding to current events that were happening, and there was a lot of the just liberal kind of talking points about Trump being this aberration. And I continued writing political commentary for 4 years, and at the same time kind of being engaged in online discourse and discourse with friends and family members. And, you know, eventually I started submitting my work to the Hampton Institute as well. It's a working class think tank. I highly recommend them. A shout out to Colin, the founder of Hampton Institute. So they were publishing my work as well. And sometime last year, I got the idea that I could combine all of the political commentary into a book. And it's kind of like, it helps me kind of communicate my own political evolution and kind of how I was radicalized, and relay that information to others who might have a similar trajectory, similar views. And kind of a lot of progressives were very disappointed, to say the least, in the outcome of, you know, both the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections. You know, most people considering themselves progressives were supporting Bernie Sanders, obviously. And I thought that this like body of work that I assembled was kind of a little bit of an alternative perspective on the Trump era, the Trump years, and articulating kind of my own feelings about this whole progressive movement and the need for it to shift towards a more revolutionary form of politics rather than this politics of reform that has overwhelmingly failed, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world. You know, I wanted to push people towards finding out more about the radical history of socialism and communism and the great successes that it has had throughout history, throughout the world as well. I published it through Lulu. It's kind of a self-publishing company, print-on-demand service. That was pretty much the beginning of August. So it's been out for a few months, and highly encourage people to check it out. If you follow me on social media, I do have a link tree in my bio that goes to basically all the links of different ways to purchase the book. So on Instagram, at this point, my main account is Matthew the Marxist. And then for Twitter, my account is MatthewJohn666. I have a link tree. And there is a way to get a PDF download as well through Etsy. During the pandemic, the early years of COVID-19, I was writing more, but I was also posting more kind of leftist memes and things like that. I was getting a lot of attention, and I was having really good conversations just on messages regarding leftist politics. And like I said, I was kind of learning during this time as well. You know, the term baby leftist is thrown out a lot. So that's kind of what I was at that point. I didn't have I didn't espouse Marxism necessarily at that point. I was just like, you know, fuck everything, basically. So I started this podcast with my sister. It's called This American Left. And then right when we started it, I also reserved that same name for an Instagram account. And it was going to be like, you know, the Instagram account for the podcast. So basically what I ended up doing was I just kept posting political content on that Instagram page. And obviously progressive and leftist views are becoming more prevalent with younger folks, millennials and Zoomers. And so, yeah, this content did resonate with a lot of people and it ended up getting a lot more followers. And this continued for, you know, a couple of years and eventually had a more than 50,000 followers. And I had also included a lot of resources for people to check out for furthering their own political education. And, you know, I'm by no means an expert. I'm still learning. So I kind of wanted to just have a lot of resources that I found valuable available to others. I just kept expanding my own political views. And eventually I arrived at more of a revolutionary Marxist approach. So I wanted to share that with people. And a lot of that was including some Marxist theory. And I struggle with learning theory, but it's something that everybody does at their own pace. And it is important. But also just, like I said, kind of debunking a lot of the anti-communist myths. So there's a lot of kind of claims that originate with either the US or the, you know, the US government, the State Department or the CIA, as well as just capitalist countries or capitalist institutions and nonprofits. And a lot of these right-wing think tanks as well. So there's all this misinformation about the history of communism and socialism. So I wanted to make that information available as much as possible. And I was, yeah, continuing to post communist memes, leftist memes, and a lot of it was resonating. And I had a lot of great conversations with folks. I met a lot of good friends. But unfortunately, Instagram had to get involved and ban my account. So the account no longer exists, but I did start a backup account, This American Left 2. But also, you know, my sister and I have done a few episodes of the podcast. I think we've done up to 10 now. It's very inconsistent because we're both very busy, but, you know, we enjoy talking about a lot of these issues from a leftist standpoint and try to kind of spread that information and that perspective. So I was very much enthusiastic about the both of the Bernie Sanders campaigns. You know, I was, like I said, someone who was between a liberal and a leftist for a lot of my life, just kind of voting for Democrats as the lesser of two evils. So I was very inspired by Bernie Sanders and him actually talking about the material conditions because, you know, once I got out of college, it was basically the Great Recession and I had to work just jobs that were not in my field of study, jobs that were not paying me enough. I had to work two jobs for a lot of the time. So Bernie's message was really resonating with me, as it was with a lot of Americans. So I was very supportive of both of his campaigns. But then the problem was, you know, afterwards, as much as we knew that Bernie would endorse the whoever was the candidate for the Democratic Party, it still was very disheartening to hear him endorse Biden, someone who, you know, I've denounced, you know, in my writing a lot, and someone who is, I believe, a reactionary and a conservative and an imperialist. But, you know, this is kind of the pattern that we've seen in American politics of, you know, there's someone who might be a little bit anti-establishment and they get maybe some traction, but the overall system of capitalism is not disturbed by this. And these bourgeois elections don't really make a difference regardless of who wins. And I saw that pattern kind of repeating throughout my life over the last, you know, roughly two decades since I started learning about this stuff. So I was really sick of this kind of pattern, and I just kept kind of broadening my horizons and looking for new analyses of, you know, what was going on in the US and this whole process of trying to change society, you know, trying to make a more progressive society where human need is met. You know, the whole point of socialism, as I understood it at the time, was, you know, trying to have the working class in control and using an industry for human need. And I was like, you know, how do we even do this? So I started coming across, you know, a little bit more Marxist literature. I did read State and Revolution by Vladimir Lenin, which was, it changed my perspective a lot in terms of, you know, what does the working class have to do in order to achieve this kind of system. And this was, you know, written between the two Russian revolutions of 1917. So when the provisional government was in power, but they had not yet seized state power through the Bolshevik Party. So it's an interesting perspective. And, you know, I kept reading other books such as Black Shirts and Reds by Michael Parenti, which does a lot to defend the history of socialism and promote revolutionary politics and debunk, like I was saying, the anti-communist propaganda. There were other books kind of about the history of socialism, such as there's a book by Walter Rodney. It has a few different titles, but it's basically about the Russian Revolution. One of the titles is A View, The Russian Revolution, A View from the Third World. There's a book by Vijay Prashad called Red Star Over the Third World. These are kind of both about the vast successes and the inspiration of the Russian Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution. So I started developing this analysis and this perspective that there actually were immense successes in the history of communist movements that are just whitewashed because of the kind of McCarthyist and Cold War mentality that still persists in the US. You know, I read like A Blood in My Eye by George Jackson, which is just a very visceral kind of description of possible revolutionary actions within the US. I was kind of reading, I guess, throughout this whole time period, books about US foreign policy and the sort of anti-communist nature of it in many cases. And I read The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins, which is kind of about this secret history of the US kind of engaging in anti-communist mass murder around the world and supporting some of these fascist or capitalist regimes that have conducted kind of large-scale mass murder to prevent socialism from taking root. So it's a lot of this information is very eye-opening and just kind of furthers the radicalization process, as well as the notion that we do have this very strong history in the communist movement of successes and of fighting for a better world and of empowering the working class on a large scale. And that's something that I realized, something that I espoused, something that I continue to promote, you know, and that's one of the main differences I realized in my outlook since the Bernie Sanders campaigns have ended. When I started thinking more about the Democratic Party specifically and how there's all this, just the discourse was very saturated with kind of liberal talking points that either were saying, you know, the Democratic Party is actually good and you should support them, or at least saying, you know, they're the lesser of two evils. We need to support them over Republicans, just as like a starting point for further action. And so there are all these analyses that just kind of, in one way or another, promoted the Democratic Party. But the problem was, I started looking into more of the history of both Biden and Obama, because, you know, Obama was president for 8 years, and without getting into, you know, the details, a lot of people just kind of assumed he was a good president. But then when you start looking into his record, you know, he deported more immigrants than any previous president. He was called the deporter in chief. He expanded a lot of the Bush administration's foreign policy. So he did like 10 times as many drone strikes as George W. Bush, something that people didn't realize at first because it was covert. He was funding jihadist terrorists in Syria with about $1 billion of weapons. And this, you know, everyone knows about the Syrian civil war, which, you know, I think it should be called a proxy war. Extremely devastating, like unimaginable suffering and death and destruction. And, you know, this was basically initiated by Obama and the CIA taking advantage of the so-called Arab Spring at the time. People don't really think about too much the NATO destruction of Libya, previously the most prosperous country in Africa with the highest standard of living. There was universal health care, universal housing. It was a very functional and thriving society. And as, you know, this was before Syria, you know, Obama was supporting terrorists once again, as U.S. presidents often do throughout history. And, you know, the destruction of Libya was extremely detrimental and just horrifying. And it's one of these things that you don't hear much from liberals and other people in your life that might be promoting the Democratic Party. Obama also prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all previous presidents combined. Basically a war on whistleblowers that was, you know, continued under Trump, obviously. And the list goes on. You know, he bailed out the banks. He had his Heritage Foundation-inspired healthcare plan, which just was kind of a bailout to the health insurance companies that kept the for-profit healthcare system intact. So there's this vast history of like all of these presidents going back throughout U.S. history having overwhelmingly the same policies of austerity against the working class, politics of you know, imperialism, violent, you know, militarism. And when it really comes down to it, you can't quantify which party is more or less evil. The evil is overwhelming for both parties. And, you know, I just kind of tried to challenge people to think about the under-discussed or whitewashed or omitted aspects of the Democratic Party. And I challenge people to see these two parties as not really separate or different, but as the political apparatus of the capitalist class. Electoral politics in a capitalist society is not a vehicle for change. That's been demonstrated so many times throughout history, including in the US. So I would say the labor movement is one place to get involved in terms of unionizing your workplace or just in getting involved in union and labor organizing. We also need, you know, history is pretty clear that you do need organized political structures to gain power. So there are socialist and communist political parties in the US. They're pretty small at this point, but I would definitely encourage people to check out some of these parties, such as Communist Party USA, as well as Party for Socialism and Liberation. Those are some of the most popular ones at this point. And other than that, you know, continue educating yourself and those around you. I think that's very important, especially these analyses that denounce electoral politics, because I see this as really a dead end and something that's, you know, everything is getting worse, and electoral politics is basically leading us nowhere, allowing the capitalists to continue to control the economic system, continuing to engage in imperialist wars of aggression that put the entire world in danger as the threat of nuclear war continues to build. So, you know, these are some ideas and some things that I'd like people to consider.